Did you know that the great scientist Einstein named 5 unsolved mysteries of physics? And did you know that Einstein made a fundamental mistake that stopped him from being able to solve some of those mysteries?
Hello and welcome to the BC Messenger podcast. This is Season 3, Episode 10. It's May 2025, and you're listening to Real Science, Real Bible, Real History, and Real World. My name is Steve Hall, and I'm here with my wife, Jennifer, sitting across from me, and we are glad that you've joined us today.
We are back again with another episode of your favorite Bible Science podcast, and I'm going to let our audience in on a little secret here, behind-the-scenes glimpse. This is take 2.
Don't tell them.
Of season 3, episode 10. In the podcasting life, sometimes you just don't get it the first time around.
Yep.
But this is fresh for your ears, and we are so glad to have you joining us today as we delve into numerous fascinating topics.
Well, it's graduation season. It's May. Well, not just graduation, it's wedding season, and it's just that time of year. But especially at graduations, you know, you think about how much human potential is displayed when these students walk across the platform when they receive their diplomas. Countless individuals will walk across the graduation stage, and then they'll go out to perform their life's work.
We've received one graduation invitation from a friend already this month, and there's a young man who's grown up so fast, can't believe he's graduating from high school and looks like he's ready to go out and do something. We have two graduates within our own children this month. We have a son graduating with his master's, and then we have a son graduating from eighth grade and having a ceremony associated with that. And, you know, you go to those ceremonies, especially the ones, you know, the universities, the colleges, with hundreds of graduates, and the ceremony drags on and on and on. And you sit there and you listen to important people say all these important things and all these names read, and the pomp and circumstance, right? That's the name of the music that's played as they march in. But literally, the pomp and the circumstance and all of the rituals that we do, but rightly so, because it's a huge occasion to complete education and then be ready to go out and fulfill a mission, fulfill a calling of some sort.
That's right. And each graduate today is standing on the shoulders of giants in any field that they're in. We have had giants in the past, giants today in fields of medicine and science, and there will be giants in the future. But again, the potential's huge.
I think it was Isaac Newton that said that if I have seen further, it's because I am standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, right.
And he said that hundreds of years ago. And look where we are even today.
Yeah, look where we are today. So many discoveries. We have so many benefits that we don't even think about. But how much more lies ahead? How many more problems are there to be solved? Do we have any problems that still need to be solved? We sure do. Now, here at where we're at, this Bible science field of research that's here at the Biblical Chronologist, we are seeing so many doors being opened because of taking the Bible seriously, taking science seriously, and boy, do we have something to share with you today, and specifically with a giant from the past named Albert Einstein. Did he not make so many discoveries in our world? And are we not benefiting today from his discoveries? And yet, mysteries that he couldn't solve, that today we're going to delve into one specifically that can be solved when you don't make the mistake that Einstein made.
So here's our rundown of content for today. Solving one of Einstein's greatest mysteries, Einstein's biggest mistake, is the subtitle there. And that's our featured topic. But we have a lot of other good stuff as well. We have a humorous but interesting quote of note to share briefly. We have an interview coming up. We don't have a ton of guests on our podcast. We are not really a guest-oriented podcast. We're always presenting research to you research results. And so that doesn't really lend itself so much to having guests like so many other podcasts do. But from time to time, we do have a guest. And today we're going to hear from Larry, age 79, as he very clearly has a great story to share about his experience with Dr. Aardsma's anti-aging vitamins, which of course are flowing out of the Bible science research being done here. Can't wait to get to that section with Larry today. And then closing out, we have Helen's View, and she will be sharing part two of Lessons from the Life of yet another great man, great scientist, Charles Goodyear.
So is this true? Dr. Aardsma knew Einstein had made a big mistake in physics, and he set out to correct Einstein. He was going to figure out this problem in geophysics that Einstein made. That's not true, is it?
Wrong.
No, that's wrong.
Not true.
We are not here today to talk about this topic because Dr. Aardsma set out to figure this problem out. Here's the deal. When discoveries are made, and this is, boy, we maybe heard this before, but now we see it with our own eyes. When discoveries are made, it always opens up other discoveries, but also other problems that need to be solved. For instance, we are talking about this today because back in the, I guess, the 90s, Dr. Aardsma began to figure out the date of the flood.
He was investigating one question.
Right. The flood. Find out the chronology. He's the biblical chronologist. And if this event happened in the earth, as the Bible says, we should be able to find it.
We need to know when was it.
When it happened.
If we can't pin it down, as we've said before, if we cannot pin down a date for Noah's flood, we might as well be talking about Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Right. So let's get this date. And that's what he was after way back in the early 90s.
So that was the question. When did the flood happen? Well, that led to, once he discovered this, the date of the flood, then that led to the geographical extent of the flood on the earth, which led to the nature of the flood. You know, how it actually
transpired. What was it actually like?
Right. And that led to the mechanism behind the flood. What caused it in the earth? How did it happen? Which opened the door to understanding all kinds of things. Mysteries of geophysics. It just keeps expanding. And this is part of understanding science, discovery, and the realization that you have the truth, that this is how these things work. More knowledge yields more mystery.
Right. And the human experience of standing in front of a mystery, having that God-given desire to solve that mystery, and in that, you're fulfilling the God-given commission to take dominion of this earth. So that's the journey that's happened. And in this investigation of Noah's flood, it has led to places, even like where we're going today on the podcast, that Dr. Aardsma never dreamed. And we didn't either, even 5, 10 years ago ourselves.
It specifically has led to an answer to one of Einstein's greatest mysteries.
This is one of the many outflows of this research work.
That's where we're headed today. So Albert Einstein, he contributed numerous breakthroughs in his contributions to science. His discoveries include both special and general relativity, the photoelectric effect, the mass-energy equivalence formula, mathematical explanation for Brownian motion. Einstein ushered in the era of modern physics. And one of the greatest unsolved mysteries left behind by Einstein was that of the origin of Earth's magnetic field. Earth's magnetic field. What is its origin?
Here's a quote we have in the show notes. I found this same reference all over the place online. Not an actual original source, though, which is very interesting. So maybe one of our listeners could go out and dig up that original source. But many, many people are referencing the fact that Albert Einstein worked diligently but unsuccessfully to understand the origin of Earth's magnetic field, which he considered to be one of the five most important unsolved problems in physics. Five problems that he thought were very important, and one of them being the origin of Earth's magnetic field.
Right. Now, today we're going to get into an outline. We're just going to go right down the outline and talk about it. But we've given you here at the beginning sort of a summary, the problem that we're facing and or that Einstein faced and how Dr. Aardsma has come to the answer through biblical research, Bible science research. So why don't we get into that now? Our outline.
It's alliterated.
Alliterated. I am a pastor and I love alliterated outlines. Well, they help me. They help me think and think through a topic. And so we're going to do that today. The man, the mystery, the mistake, and then the solution to the mystery at the end. So,
and we also have another M in there, the magnetic field.
Magnetic field.
The man, yep. The mystery, the magnetic field,
lots
the
of
mistake.
M's.
Okay.
All right.
Here
the
we
man.
Go.
Let's talk about Albert Einstein for a moment. Again, just a review of who was this man, Albert Einstein. Well, he was a Jew. Most people know that. He was a physicist, born a German, and later became a Swiss citizen and then an American citizen. Interesting facts about Albert Einstein.
He lived from 1879 to 1955. So that is the year, in fact, this is just dawning on me as we are recording this. That is the year Dr. Aardsma was born.
Huh.
You had Einstein there in the late 1800s to the first half of the 1900s, and he lived through World War II, and he was a Jew. He was not in Germany at the time, but just a fascinating life story, and I learned a little bit about him getting ready for the podcast. He loved physics, loved the material world, was very devoted to figuring out these puzzles. So, for example, at the tender age of 26, Einstein published four groundbreaking papers all in one year, which was 1905, and rocked the physics world of his day. We separate between classical physics and modern physics, and the work that Einstein did was able to usher in that era of modern physics.
You may have heard of the term special and general relativity. This was part of his discoveries, the photoelectric effect. We've all heard of the famous equation, E equals MC squared. How can you talk about Einstein and not...
That's the mass energy equivalence formula.
Yes.
I mean, you know, E equals MC squared.
Sure, yeah.
How hard can that be to figure out?
Write that on the chalkboard.
Just three letters, an equal sign, a number there, you know? Okay. All right.
This is Einstein, mathematical explanation of Brownian motion. Some of you science buffs out there know what all these things are about.
And you know, here's something interesting. Special and general relativity. And as I was working on this, I thought, oh, I should switch that. It should be general and special. Because wouldn't you think you'd discover the general first and the special second? But actually, it was the special relativity first. And then it took him like 10 additional years to do his theory of general relativity. So that was surprising to me. And maybe some trivia there for our audience.
Yeah.
In 1921, so... What was that? 16 years after he published those four groundbreaking papers, he received a Nobel Prize in physics. One of the unique things about Einstein's life was that he gained recognition and acclamation in his own day. And so as an older man,
right,
would often be stopped on the sidewalk, take pictures with me and my kids. And he would do the favor and stand there and smile. And then I read he would walk off mumbling to himself, the old elephant goes through his tricks again. But
right.
he was just at the right time and the right moment in history to be discovering the things that he did and the way that it was put forward by the press and it was even somewhat giving a hope to people in the midst of the world wars. So that was his life story. Now, many, many great scientists never received any recognition in their day.
Yeah, but he kind of became a rock star. A scientist, right, becomes kind of a pop culture icon
right.
of his day. So that's Albert Einstein, the man. And again, most all of us are familiar with Albert Einstein, but there was some mysteries that Einstein couldn't figure out. And we're going to present to you the reason why he could not figure those mysteries out in just a moment. But what was one of those mysteries? We're gonna delve into one today. Apparently, he listed five most important unsolved problems in physics.
I could not find the list of the five problems. Now, I did not read his whole biography. It's very, very thick. I only read some small pieces of it. So if anybody is that source, here are the five problems he listed. But we do know that one of them, quoted widely from many sources, is this origin of the geomagnetic field.
So let's talk about that. A brief introduction today, just quickly, into Earth's magnetic field. Now, again, we're going somewhere with this. We're going to present to you the answer for this that Dr. Arzmà has discovered by not making the same mistake that Einstein made. But what is this thing of Earth's magnetic field? What do we know today, and what do we think we know today?
We watched a lot of YouTube videos. We had a meeting with Dr. Arzmà, so we... the podcast host here can communicate this to you in some sensible way. Magnetism itself is kind of a mystery to me, and I don't really understand a whole lot of the science behind it. Apparently, Einstein, as a young man, as a boy, was very fascinated with magnetism and was making theories about it. Of course, magnetism, you cannot see it, but it causes things that you can see.
We've all experienced magnets, right? How cool is that to have a magnet and that piece of metal or iron, whatever that is, just, you know, comes right up to it. How does that? It's like magic.
Yep.
Well, there's physics behind it. Well, the Earth is a magnet. Did you know that?
We are living on an enormous magnet. The magnetism of the Earth originates from the center of the Earth and extends all the way out into space going around the Earth. That's incredible of itself.
So we have today something called a compass. Have you ever wondered how a compass works? How does that needle always point to the north? Well, it's because the Earth's a magnet, right? The magnetic north pole is what we're talking about, and that's why we can have that direction on a compass given to us.
Yes, it's also the reason that birds are able to fly a specific direction. That would be a study of itself. I would love to know how magnetism works inside of a bird, but somehow it is causing direction for the migration of birds. It causes the beautiful northern lights.
Yeah. Well, because, if I'm understanding this right, it is protecting the Earth from all kinds of elements in space, harmful rays, harmful particles.
Right.
And so that's why we see those beautiful northern lights.
It's particles from the sun are being pulled in there at the poles, and that's causing these lights in the sky at night.
And the magnetic field is protecting Earth, protecting life on this Earth. Fascinating science and discovery.
There are so many ways to see the magnetic field of the Earth manifest. Scientists study it in so many ways. If you are a geologist, you study rock layers. And did you know there are magnetized particles in the rock layers of the Earth that are pulled in one direction in that rock layer, but then there are other rock layers where the magnetization, the particles are being pulled in the opposite direction. So we have that and other types of evidence that the magnetic field of the Earth has reversed in the past.
It shows us that. Yeah, amazing.
The magnetic field is stronger at times and weaker at times. So they're learning all, you know, we know we have all of this. Fascinating. but it's not like a permanent magnet where, you know, it just does what it does and nothing ever changes it.
Right.
It is changing.
It's variable.
It is wobbling. It is even the pole, the magnetic pole itself is moving across the top of the globe there.
Right.
So all of these effects going on with this amazing planet.
So these are the things that we know today, that scientists today know, that we have this magnetic field. It's a variable magnet, like you just said. We know it's stemming from the core of the Earth. We have a solid inner core surrounded by fluid. We watched a video the other day on YouTube, and what a great day we live in. If you want to get educated on something, you can, it's at your fingertips. And
yeah, you talk about standing on the shoulders of giants. My goodness.
And Jennifer showed me a video of this scientist, a young fellow, standing at a chalkboard trying to explain and describe the Earth's magnetic field. And he's showing the inner core, and he's showing how all these, this movement going on in the fluid of the inner core is causing the variable magnetic field.
And he's passionate. Shift. He's excited.
Yeah.
He loves explaining this. And I just love to see, you know, somebody who is using their life to delve into these mysteries God has built into the earth.
Right. But the problem is there are some things today that we know, but there are some other things that we think we know and don't exactly have it right. And you realize this when new truth, is that a good way to put it? When realizations, discoveries come about and you understand things because you were given information you didn't have before or you took information seriously and a door is open, then you're like, whoa, okay, they weren't right about that. And this guy, again, on the video that we watched,
he is presenting the commonly accepted theory today. So Einstein didn't know. Where is this magnetic field originating
the
from?
Where is it originating from? Right.
Right. And then some scientists since that time have come up with a theory called the geodynamo theory. And it has been worked on, solidified, developed. And today it's the generally accepted theory for where and how we get this magnetic field that's in the Earth.
Right.
So the guy on the video kind of gave a little bit of a clue, though, as to the fact that this isn't the best theory ever. He was very excited and drawing all these arrows and doing all this and talking about how then this happens, then this happens. And at one point he said, we hope.
Right.
Because there are problems with the geodynamo theory. There are aspects of Earth's magnetic field that are not explained at all through the geodynamo theory.
Right.
And that's partly what we're going to talk about.
Well, and apparently a scientist came up with this theory. I don't remember the name, but approached Einstein with it, and Einstein didn't like it, that it was too messy, he said. And in Einstein's brilliant mind, it didn't work.
He did not like the geodynamo theory. Didn't grab him, which, you know, you think about a guy like him who is understanding mysteries about the speed of light and mysteries about so many huge things in our planet. But yet when it came to this question, he said, no, I don't like it. I don't like
right.
that theory.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
And so he was left with the mystery, did not believe it had been solved.
Dr. Aardsma has weighed in on the geodynamo theory. We asked him when we were having that meeting with him a few weeks ago to get ready for this podcast.
What does he think?
In general, I mean, we know that that's not your theory, but do you think it's a good theory? And what did he say?
He said it's terrible.
He said, no, it's a terrible theory.
It's a terrible theory. All right. Well,
why would he say that? Well, because he is talking about how it does not explain so many of the aspects of Earth's magnetic field. And we learned a new term.
Viscosity? Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Viscosity. Well, see, this, and let's just again touch on it. The geodynamo effect is what they're calling it, has everything to do with the fluid that's inside the Earth. And that this magnetic field is generated within the fluid itself, motion and heat and all
right.
of that.
Right. Let me read this technical explanation. The geodynamo is due to convective outer core fluid motions. Convection is believed to be fueled in part by gravitational potential energy, which is released by precipitation of iron from outer core fluid onto the solid inner core as the core slowly cools.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's exactly what
I'm saying. Yeah.
That.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's so, the geodynamo.
Right. So the viscosity of the outer core's fluid. Now, like you said, that's a new word that we learned. This is unknown. And didn't Dr. Arspa say something about that? This is one of the biggest unknowns.
It's a huge unknown. Viscosity means how thick is the
right.
fluid.
How thick or thin
how
is it?
How flowable is it? You know, you have something like honey, and it's going to have a certain viscosity. And then you have water, and you right. have other fluids. I don't know. You name one. But this fluid that surrounds the inner core, of course, nobody can go down there. Nobody can see it. And so we have to deduce things about it just from what we can see and observe. And the viscosity of the fluid has everything to do with how or why or the magnetic field can reverse and those types of questions.
It's like it's molten iron and metals. I mean, this fluid, it's not water we're talking about here. That's my point. I mean,
right.
we're talking about a melted, very hot fluid. So as we continue to go through what we're explaining to you, remember that fact that the viscosity of the fluid is a key issue here, the thickness or the thinness. And would you believe the Bible? The Bible is going to give us information on the viscosity of the fluid of the inner core of the earth.
I don't remember reading that verse.
Yeah, right. Hang with us because we're going to show this to you. It's fascinating.
Thou shalt right. know the viscosity of the inner core of the earth.
There's data. There's data to be seen.
Right. So this is a little bit of a spoiler, but also a teaser.
Yeah, right. Stay with
us. Of course, this is a Bible science podcast, and so you shouldn't be surprised. But yet, it's amazing all that we can learn. It's amazing where we can go with this train of research. Okay.
All right. We've seen the man.
Yep.
And then we've seen the mystery, Einstein's one of his greatest mysteries. And now let's look at the mistake. What is the mistake that Einstein made from the start that did not allow him to understand what we are presenting today? Dr. Arzma made a statement when we were meeting with him. I jotted it down. Throwing out the truth at the start, you will never find the answer. Throwing out the truth at the start, you will never find the answer. Now, that seems like a basic statement, but it's the truth. And here's what he threw out from the very beginning. The premise that he had...
Einstein.
The premise that Einstein had that biblical history is not credible. That the ancient accounts that we have, the historical accounts... Again, we have to remember the Bible is a lot of books within one book. And there's different types of literature. There's poetry, there's prophecy, there's law. But there's also history, historical records. For instance, the book of Genesis, the book of Exodus... He, from the beginning, did not see those accounts as credible.
And it's not just Einstein. I mean, you know, 90% or more of the scientific world today would fully agree with Einstein. Of course, we do not go to the Bible to solve mysteries of physics. How often do we hear that? The Bible is not a science book. All right, well, it may not be a science textbook. Like I said, you can't look up the verse to tell you the viscosity, but it's a book full of data and information, and we've hit that time and time again on this podcast. If you toss aside that data, you throw out that ancient history, then you are turning your back on the most valuable resource you have to learn things about this planet. You can't learn any other way. You know, that statement, toss out the truth at the beginning and you will never find the answer. I homeschooled my children for many years. I watched them, looked over their shoulder as they took standardized testing every year. And, you know, if it's a multiple choice question and the child is looking at the options A, B, C, or D, and I'm looking there knowing the answer is B, and the child says, it's not B, you know, then they're choosing between the other three. And I'm just cringing, knowing you're not going to pick the right answer. You've already
thrown it out.
You've already negated the one that is the right answer. And so that's what's going on here. Early in life, Einstein, because of many factors, rejected the biblical accounts. He was reading the popular scientific literature. He became distrustful of some of his educators that he had early in life, which he had developed a deep religiosity. But through various factors, a lot of it was the popular science of the day, he decided the Bible stories largely could not be true.
Right.
And I mean, there's like one or two sentences in his biography that states that. And then it moves on to talk about how he was a deist. He had so much faith in the rational world, and he knew there was a God behind that. But as his life went on, he did trend maybe more towards agnosticism, and he definitely did not believe in a personal God who was involved in the affairs of men. His God almost became the science itself. And that was his religious views, his experience. He certainly was not taking the Bible seriously.
And this has carried on. I think you mentioned that. Unfortunately, even within Christianity today, our apologetics are always theological. Theological, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. But not data-rich to show that the Bible accounts happened in the real world. And that is a major, major part of what we are doing here.
Well, and this Bible science branch of research work is so new that we're not used to it. It almost feels offensive or like we're pulling the Bible down too low or something to say that it's going to talk to us about the viscosity of the fluid surrounding the inner core of the earth. I mean, this is the book that I read on Sunday and I hear preached from the pulpit, and I go to it for comfort and for spiritual truth and to learn about Jesus. And so why would you be wanting to talk about physics in the Bible? And that is what the Bible science branch of the sciences needs to bring forward, the valuable, invaluable things that we can learn as we take it as real, true data, history, information.
Exactly. Well, that was the mistake that he made from the start. He cast it aside, did not even pay attention to the data in the Bible, this ancient document, at all. And
now it was kind of the climate of his day.
Give him a pass, maybe, with that.
You have sympathy for him because
right.
What was happening, you know, during that time period, the turn of the century there.
So he didn't take it seriously, whatever, you know, the reason was. So what did he miss? By throwing out that truth from the very beginning, what is the solution to the mystery of the Earth's magnetic field that he did not understand? Let's talk about that next.
Right. Science of his day was moving away from the supernatural and the superstitious, and it was very, very much focused on measuring things and looking at data. And so that was made it very easy for him to walk away from the Bible's written record. But as you've said, there was something so key there that if he could have understood, he could have solved these mysteries.
When we look at the historical accounts in the Bible, we come to books such as Genesis. Genesis contains an account of a worldwide event, a man who observed it firsthand and documented everything he observed. His name was Noah. And in the account of Noah's flood, we have documented for us there something that transpired on this earth that
had a real cause behind it.
That's right. And by understanding the cause behind that event, we have now had doors of mystery opened up to us like never before. in some of these areas. And this is the solution. You must understand what we have labeled, Dr. Arzma has here labeled noaic events within this earth in order to understand a mystery such as Earth's magnetic field, the origin of Earth's magnetic field.
Noaic events. Okay. Noah's flood. Noah's flood is the most recent noaic event. But taking all the data given in Genesis and Noah's records, investigating it, understanding the physics of the earth, going down that path of discovery that we laid out at the beginning, you eventually come to understand that Noah's flood was caused by the solid inner core of the earth traveling up through the liquid, fluid outer core.
Uh-huh. Now
and
we're getting
back
to our word.
That is the fundamental thing that's happening that causes a noaic event. Who knew that our planet could do this? Scientists today do not know it. Noah did not know what the planet was doing on the inside, but he saw all the effects.
And he wrote it down.
And you get the effects, you can trace back to the cause. And so that's a noaic event. It has to do with the earth contracting and expanding during one of these events. And lo and behold, you understand that our planet can do this. And mysteries, long held mysteries of geophysics, begin to just have light bulb after light bulb after light bulb coming on because of this fundamental cause that happens inside the earth.
So backing up a little bit, if we go back, and you can go, scientific records show ice core data, I guess all of these things demonstrate that we can go back a long way in Earth's history, back into what we call here virtual history, and we can see that something keeps happening. There's these peaks on these graphs that show, you know, between hundreds of thousands of years, something keeps taking place, something keeps happening in the Earth. And Dr. Arzma, again, is calling these noaic events, calling it noaic because the last one that took place in the earth was the what we have recorded in the book of Genesis and what this man Noah jotted down as he was going on and kept records of. And so, yes, again, we're just skimming the surface here. You can go into the details with Dr. Arzma's writings and the book on the flood, but that inner core of the earth is not stable, and it is shifted off of center.
Through a core collapse event.
Core collapse event. Now, maybe you've heard of antipodal hotspots. It's another question that all of this answers. That shifts the core off center in this earth, and that core begins to move through the fluid, but it doesn't move fast. And this is what, a little bit ago, we said, did you know the Bible gives us the answer to the viscosity of the fluid in the earth? Well, the measurements you can take from this biblical account, as Noah wrote down, how many days did it rain? How many days did it take for the wind to blow? And all
yeah,
of
I mean,
that.
My jaw just dropped. Okay, because I recently realized this. Dr. Arzma said to us, the classic experiment that you perform to find out the viscosity of a fluid is you drop a ball through the liquid and you see how fast it travels. And I'm like, okay, well,
that's exactly
what
happened.
The Earth's inner core moves off of center. It collides with the mantle underneath. And then Noah records how long it takes for the water to recede and all of the other scientific observations there as the core very slowly moved back down to the center.
To the
and
center.
I mean, there's equations and there's all kinds of science and physics going
well,
into
he,
all
Dr.
of this.
Dr. Arzma talked about when that core moves off of center, then there's a collapse, core collapse in the center of the earth. It, that involves contraction and expansion of the earth. And that is where the magnetic field fundamentally comes from. Now, I'm sitting here with a copy of Dr. Arzma's book, Noah's Flood Happened, 3520 BC. And if you really want to wrap your brain around a noaic event, this is what you need to read. This book has all the details in it about the flood, Dr. Arzma's research into the flood, the mechanism behind the flood. And specifically, we want to go to a chapter in the book and a certain section that demonstrates how a noaic event generates new magnetic field within the Earth.
We wanted to read this section for our listeners who are more scientifically oriented. So there's some terminology here that will resonate with you and help you to grasp more fully what we're trying to put in layman's terms for the most part here. This book, Noah's Flood Happened 3520 BC, is available at the BC Store. Go to our website, thebcmessenger.com. Click on Shop up in the corner, and you can very easily get a hold of this book, either a hard copy or a PDF download.
I'm going to begin reading on page 296 of the book, about in the middle of the page. Noaic events point in another direction entirely. And again, this is in contrast to the modern-day geodynamo theory of what generates the magnetic field within the Earth.
He's explained some about the geodynamo right before the section now that Steve's going to read.
Right. Noaic events point in another direction entirely. They imply that Earth's magnetic field is due to a totally different sort of electromagnetic machine. Most of the concepts and processes which have come to be associated with the geodynamo are not applicable to this new machine. While this new machine may also be called a geodynamo, in the sense that any device which converts energy of motion to electrical energy is a dynamo, I will call it a geogenerator, in an effort to avoid confusion between the old and the new machines.
That's cool. So we have the geodynamo theory, and this is the geogenerator theory associated with our knowledge of noaic events.
The geogenerator is fueled by contraction of the core during a noaic event, not by convection of fluid within the core. It is a simple Faraday induction machine. Faraday's law of induction states that the electric current induced in a loop of wire by a magnetic field is proportional to the rate of change of total magnetic flux threading the loop. Think of the core as made up of a large number of conducting loops or rings. These rings are all aligned perpendicular to and concentric with the north-south geomagnetic axis. They are all threaded by magnetic field lines from Earth's magnetic dipole field. When the core contracts during a noaic event, these rings all become smaller. Focus on one ring, say the equatorial ring. Magnetic field lines, which had been inside this ring but out near its radius before contraction, will, after contraction, be outside the ring. Thus, it is seen that the total magnetic flux inside each of these conducting loops will change with time during the flood. This change of flux with time induces new currents in all the rings in accordance with Faraday's law of induction. These new currents generate new magnetic field.
Okay, so that's just a small portion. Of course, everything preceding that in the book is going to be giving more foundational information for everything we just read there. But you're getting the sense that there is a contraction happening within the inner core of the Earth, and that is generating this new magnetic field in accordance with Faraday's law of induction. So get the book. And
if you're tracking along in the science of this, that is helpful in understanding the laws, the principle behind what is producing this magnetic field and how the core is acting as a machine to produce it, right?
That is basically a recharge of the Earth's magnetic field every time over multiple thousands of years one of these events happens, and we can see all these effects back through history. The magnetic field is going to be affected in some way. I don't understand the science, but the core traveling through that liquid is generating and regenerating the electric currents that are causing this magnetic field. So each noaic event way back in virtual history, each one is going to settle out with the magnetic field different than it was before. Yeah. And sometimes, even if all the factors come into play in the right way, the field will be the opposite direction than it was before.
This also answers questions like, why is it variable? Why it can even change direction? It answers all of these questions. And you can only find this answer when you take Genesis seriously. The account given to us by Noah, the record of the event that took place. Had Albert Einstein believed the story of Noah's flood and investigated the data that Noah has recorded in Genesis, he would have understood one of his greatest mysteries, the origin of Earth's magnetic field.
It all is explained so beautifully through this new understanding of our planet in this way. And not just this mystery, but many others. But this one is a huge one, of course, of itself. Who would have dreamed in our modern day, age of enlightenment, post-modern age that we're in, that we need to go back to the world's most ancient written history, which involves God himself, at least many claims about God himself, and talks about eternal destinies and these types of things. And we need to go back to that document to be able to understand these kinds of mysteries. But fundamentally, as Steve gave that summary there, we tried to boil it down to one sentence. Our son is getting his master's in communications. And so he's like, look, you got to be able to boil your message down to one sentence. So give us that sentence one more time.
Had Albert Einstein believed the story of Noah's flood, Noah's account, and investigated the data that Noah has recorded, he would have understood one of his greatest mysteries, the origin of Earth's magnetic field.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
And glory to God for the new truths that he's opening up to us today.
We don't have the story of Noah in the Bible just so that we can say, wow, what a great story. We have come to realize that God has given us this information and preserved it for all these years. And here in 2025, we can go back and see what Noah recorded 3520 BC, thereabouts, and realize the answer to some very pressing questions that now present us with other concerning questions and things that need to be now solved. But you know what? We have giants from the past. We have giants today and in the future.
And we need to be doing a lot more with this biblical data. This is just the tip of the iceberg, I believe that. And of course, there are groups today, well-known groups, building giant arcs and attracting tons of people and giving the gospel through that venue and putting the science label on there. But in that, there are no real-world explanations for this history in Genesis. There are many, many spiritual applications, and I'm not against that. But the spiritual applications lose their impact if we cannot provide the real world explanations. If we cannot talk to the Albert Einsteins and the Elon Musks, who has a similar story to Einstein as far as his boyhood and his rejection of the biblical stories. If we can't talk to them and say, oh, yes, it is real. Here's the equations. Here's the mechanism. Here's the science. Here's what it did. And you can understand it. You can work it out. You can follow that path yourself and see it for yourself. If we can't give that kind of information, then all the spiritual application in the world loses its impact. I believe that. And so Stop saying the Bible's not a science book. Take the information and subject it to science.
Because it's God's world.
Correct.
It is God's world and God's word. And when we talk about data, it's God's data. We're not just talking about opinions. We're not just talking about somebody else's, well, this is my thoughts. And that takes us into our quote of note.
Yes.
For today.
All right. So I think we've wrapped up our featured topic. I hope our audience is grasping everything that we wanted to share with you there. Fascinating discussion on that. And yeah. Okay. So this quote of note, this is a very fun quote of note. Now, who is this person that said this? James Barksdale.
James Barksdale is an American executive and served as president and CEO of Netscape,
which apparently eventually merged with AOL.
Okay. So a businessman.
So he was early in the internet era.
And had an interesting quote. He says, if we have data, let's look at data. If all we have are opinions, let's go with mine. That's pretty good. Again, I don't know this man. I don't know who he is, but good quote. If we have data, then let's look at data. If all we have are opinions, well, let's go with mine because mine's best, right? I have the best
opinion.
Right,
because I know mine's right.
Right, of course. It's my opinion.
Oh, yes. I can totally see him as a CEO, like in a meeting, you know, a board meeting or a whatever, meeting of the minds with Netscape and saying this, you know, okay, if you've got studies, if you've got numbers, if you've got hardcore data, I want to see it. If you want to sit here and tell me your opinion, I'm going to look back at you and tell you mine, and we're going to go with mine.
Right, right. Okay. We just came through Easter, and I just presented to our church the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, what are we talking about when we're talking about the importance of the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Are we talking about data, or are we talking about opinions? Well, I tried to present the fact that we aren't talking about opinions, and we are, or hearsay. We are talking about eyewitness accounts. Specifically, that's what we talked about. But we could talk about a number of other things that show data, that show historical data, that give evidence to the fact of this real-world event that took place in Earth's history. Everybody agrees with this point at Easter time, right?
Right.
At Easter, everybody agrees. Jesus is risen from the dead, physically, bodily. It happened, and you can go to the tomb and see for yourself. What is that? That's data. That's all we're talking about here. It's not the matter of, oh, well, my opinion. Now, some people think it is. My opinion, your opinion. But no, we're talking about real data, and that's right along with this quote of note.
That's what we need. To build a strong apologetic, it cannot be my opinion versus your opinion. This Christian group says this, another Christian group says this. We've got to have something else to help us to discern how to properly understand the biblical accounts. And if we are just going back to, well, I know it must be this, I think it's definitely, I've always heard it was this, about Noah's flood or about any of this biblically recorded history, we're thankful for all the data that God has given us, and we want to use it. There's a verse in Psalms, you know, he who sits in the heavens laughs because he sees the state of mankind, and he's given us so much. And when we refuse to use what he has so graciously given to us, how foolish we are as humans.
The anti-aging vitamins that we talk about here are an example of this. Taking real-world data from the ancient Old Testament and applying that data to life today, to real-world humanity, and trying to use it to resolve problems and deal with suffering and relieve suffering and disease. And we're calling it anti-aging vitamin simply because that's what it is. And or at least theoretically, this is what it's supposed to be doing. And sometimes things can sound marketed, you know what I mean? Like, but
You've got a silver solution over there.
Yeah, right. Right.
How much is it? $500 a bottle?
But right, exactly. But it's simply an example of what we've been talking about today. And we have a really neat interview that we want to show you or share with you. Jennifer interviewed a fellow by the name of Larry, 79 years old. He's a very special guy to both of us. And but Larry came into our little studio here the other day and shared his experience with supplementing Dr. Aardsma's anti-aging vitamins. He's been on the vitamins for quite a number of years now. And since that time, he's gone through cancer treatments for, with leukemia. He tolerated that very well. Not just that, but some other things that he shares in this interview. I'm not going to give any details away here, but we want you to listen to this. I think you'll be encouraged by it. We certainly were encouraged by his testimonial from taking the anti-aging vitamins. Now, before we go into the interview, let me just give a quick reminder that the vitamins we are discussing here are newly discovered vitamins. They are not a concoction of previously known vitamins or turmeric or herbs and all of that. What we are discussing here are two newly discovered vitamins, methylphosphonic acid and methylphosphinic acid, that presently you cannot get anywhere else, Dr. Aardsma's anti-aging vitamins.
Well, we're very glad to have Larry. Our friend Larry is in the studio with us today. He stopped by with his wife this morning to talk with us about his experience with Dr. Aardsma's anti-aging vitamins. And Larry has quite a story to tell, so we're thrilled to have him here. Larry and his wife Sharon are friends of ours from our church here in Illinois. We met them 5 or 6 years ago after we first moved here. And they're an inspiration to me personally, watching them as a couple and serving the Lord in our church here. It's very inspiring. So, Larry, great to have you with us today. Thank you for
coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to share my story.
Yes, that's what we want to hear. Everybody loves a story, right?
Yes.
So, first of all, let's just learn a little bit about you, Larry. You have been from Illinois all of your life?
Yes, born and raised here and all 79 years of my life so far.
Okay, I was just going to ask if you mind sharing your age.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
79. And what kind of work did you do over the years?
Well, I grew up on a dairy farm, so that was a lot of work, hard work. And my dad, I have four other brothers and two sisters, so we needed to supplement our income. Dad bought a hay baler, and we baled hay all over the country and just out all the time. And then I went into elevator business, grain elevator, and a feed, grinding feed business for 26 years. And after that was over, I got into a heating and cooling business until I retired, which was in 2014.
So lots of different variety of things, lots of agriculture that we do have around here. And when I first met you and Sharon, you were growing pumpkins.
Yes.
That was one of my first memories of you all, was going over to your house and seeing this beautiful fall display of all these pumpkins you had grown, harvested, brought over to your house, set up for display. And that was really cool.
Yeah, I do that every year, and it's my pride and joy. I just love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun.
That's great. You inspired me to have my kids try to grow some pumpkins, too.
Good.
And that's a fun thing to do in the fall. Okay, so as far as your story goes with our product here, I remember talking to you about it pretty early on. Must have been in 2020. But you can set the stage better for us. Just tell us what happened to you during that year and kind of your memories of it.
Okay. February 20th, I remember the day. It was a Sunday of 2020. I had been not feeling too good for a couple days. And that morning, I guess I passed out a little bit.
Oh.
My wife, Sharon, got excited, called Dr. Fellner in Paxton, and we went over there right away. And he did some checking and drew blood and stuff, and that afternoon he called and said, you get over here Monday morning, tomorrow morning, there's something not right.
Okay.
And did more testing, and then that same day he sent me to Dr. Saratna in Bloomington to the Cancer Institute because he assumed with my blood counts and everything that there was a very good possibility I had some type of cancer.
Okay.
So from there, it's been a blur, but I met with Dr. Saratna. Immediately they did a bone marrow sampling, and that was sent off to a research lab and came back that I had acute myeloid leukemia. So treatment started right away, and was getting 10 shots a week for 1 week, and then I was on pills for 2 other weeks, and then off 2 weeks and every month routine. And then somewhere along the line, I got together with you people, Jennifer and Steve, probably at church. We talked about it a little bit, and you wanted to set up an interview or.
I remember we did a video call we could talk to you about the discovery of these vitamins, because you had expressed interest or seemed receptive to supplements and this type of new research that we had going on here.
Right. I've taken supplements all my life. My dad did, so I thought it was necessary.
Right.
And that interview, and I mean, you didn't have to convince me because I knew that there was something that if you people believed in it, why I would too, you know. So I started taking them sometime in 2020 and was going along. Everything was going well. One of the things that was inspiring to me during this whole process was that there was supposed to be something wrong with me after I had my treatments. I mean, the doctors were just baffled them that I didn't have dizziness, diarrhea, constipation, soreness, sores in the mouth, and just aches and pains, you know.
Yeah.
And to this day, I have never experienced that. And I think that a lot of that is the good grace of God, and taking those vitamins, I think, really have helped me. You can just feel sometimes that there's something going on.
Yeah.
And I could tell that everything was working. It was just amazing, you know, and praise God for
that.
Yes,
praise the Lord. I know that's exactly how I feel because, you know, that's why I'm here doing what I'm doing, because I want to see people like you and everybody, you know, live longer, healthier lives, be able to keep doing the things that God's called them to do and be there for their families. And so I love hearing you share all that. So you were on treatments for how many years or?
Well, the process for the leukemia thing is supposed to be a series of 19 sessions.
Okay.
And dealing with Dr. Larson in Chicago, since he's in research, he took me to 26 sessions because he wanted to see what happened, you know, and if there were some positive things. And after 26 sessions, then we quit, and we sat there one day, and he said, "You're cancer-free." And
wow.
Yeah.
Recently, right? Pretty recently.
That was in 2020, the end of 23.
Oh, okay.
No, I take that back. It was in February of 23.
Okay.
And then after that, I just drew blood each month.
And they kept checking on you, so
yes,
you got a
right.
positive report again recently.
Right.
That's what I'm
right.
thinking of. Okay.
And the only thing I can attribute it to is the good Lord and Dr. Ardsma's anti-aging vitamins.
That's awesome. I love that. Now, you were saying before we came on the mics that you felt like God led you to a specialist up in Chicago that has been overseeing all of this for you.
Yes.
And is big on the research side of cancer research and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a neat part of the story too. So at this point, you don't have any ongoing treatments or medications for the leukemia at all? Or where are you at now with it?
Well, the story doesn't end there. In the fall of October of 23,
okay.
I had a itch on my back. I had a mole that became infected, and called the nurses at Gibson because I got to know them real well, and they set me up right away with a dermatologist, did a biopsy, and in 2 days it came back that I had melanoma.
Okay.
So I've been treating that ever since. And just in February, I've been given a green light that I'm cancer-free of the melanoma, but I still do immunotherapy treatments for another 6 months until the end of October. So that's where I'm at this point, and everything's going well.
Yeah.
And there again, I attribute it to the good Lord and the vitamins. I mean, it just seems to really be working well, you know, together. So,
well, praise the Lord. So I didn't even know some of those parts of the story myself. Mm-hmm. So as we wrap it up, I wanted to talk about, we just had Easter, and Larry and Sharon, as they typically do, you and your wife did a special thing for the church for Easter. And can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Sharon and I, my wife, enjoy serving people and just helping, you know, and we feel a need for it in our church, that somebody needed to step up and kind of make things happen a little bit and get people involved. So that's basically one of the main reasons why we did it, for the fellowship and to get everybody together on the same page. And we enjoy doing it. It, you know, it's all for the glory of God, and that's what we work for and strive for. So
it was a breakfast that you and Sharon put on for on Easter morning. Just the two of you did the whole thing. Is that correct?
Well, pretty much. Yeah. And we had help there serving it and stuff like that. Yeah. But we enjoy doing it, and we have the time to do it.
Yes. Praise the Lord. And the energy to do it. That's
right.
Right. So you set up for it, did decorating, and then made the food. Right?
Correct. Yes, we did.
And it was delicious.
Yeah.
We all enjoyed it. So I am so thrilled to see you all doing these things. Now, you told me at church that your doctor told you, when you kept on doing so well and handling the treatment so well, what did you say he told you? You're weird or something like that?
Yeah, okay. He did. But he, you know, he said, I understand, you know, the research part of it, and what you're doing is working, so don't stop doing it, you know. And I know that he's a man of the Lord, because every other time I would really thank him and praise him for what he's doing, and he would always stop me and say, no, I'm part of it, but it's the good Lord, you know, that's leading us through this research and guiding us. So, I mean, that was huge.
Yes. And, you know, I think that's just the kingdom of Christ.
Yes.
Spreading in the world. He's got people all over the place doing work for him.
Right.
Whether that's a cancer doctor or discovering two new vitamins or, you know, working in the church and serving people. And it's just inspiring to see people who've given their lives, you know, to defeating these enemies of Christ and defeating death through cancer or heart disease or whatever it is that we deal with. And so I love that. That's great.
Good.
Thank you for sharing all of that.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
One other thing that I'd like to share with you before we get off here is that probably for the last 30 years of my life, I've had a sciatic nerve problem in my hip.
Okay.
Inherited that from my mother. She died with it. She would get cortisone shots.
Okay.
As many as they could give in a year. I think it was only two or three or something like that. But, you know, what happened, it's a miracle. In 2023, in the middle of 2023, I realized that my hip was not bothering me anymore. And I don't know when it happened.
Wow.
But the pain is gone, and it's gone to this day.
And that's amazing.
There was days that it was excruciating, especially if I was, like in the heating cooling business, if I'd be on a stepladder a lot during the day. I'd go home at night and I'd have to, elevate my feet, but it's gone. And I don't know what happened, but
right.
I praise Dr. Aardma's anti-aging vitamins, I think, had a big part of that, because I think, Steve, you mentioned something to me about a knee or that you had trouble with or something.
Yeah, my story is similar. I had knee pain and back pain for quite a long time. And then got on the vitamins, and it cleared it up. Yeah. And we've heard that a number of testimonies. Not everybody's exactly the same, but yeah, very similar.
Wow.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were maybe a couple years in, and then you realized, or maybe 3 years, it sounds like 2020 to 2023, when you realized that the pain was gone.
Yeah. And I don't know how long before that, you know, that I realized that it actually happened, but.
Yeah, because when something stops bothering you, it doesn't come to mind. Yeah. I know, I understand.
I had a lot of other things on my mind, you know, at that time with my...
Right.
Yeah, so it's amazing.
Well, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah,
that's great. And that's encouraging for people to be faithful with supplementing because it is working in the body and it's going to do its work. But you got to be patient and give it time, and you don't know how it's going to play out. Some things it affects, and it's amazing, and then other things maybe are not as noticeable, but I love hearing that. And your stories are helping us even as the research is ongoing, because there's so much more to be found out with these vitamins, so much more to map out. What are they doing? How do they work? And so each person who takes time to share and check in with us has a part in that.
Great.
So thank you.
Well,
so much.
Yeah, and it's important that if you take care of yourself when you're younger and supplement yourself along, I think you'll live a long, healthy life. And that's why I did it, and I'm doing it. Just for instance, 2 weeks ago, we were in Branson. We went to the Sight and Sound Theater and to see the movie of David, you know, the show.
Right, okay.
And one thing that bugs me when I go to these places, I mean, it's all mainly older people.
Right.
And the canes and the walkers and the wheelchairs just drive me nuts. And I think a lot of those people could have helped themselves years ago to keep from getting into that situation.
Yeah.
I realize there's some things you can't control, but boy, spend a little money while you're younger and enjoy life as you get older.
Yeah.
Be healthy.
Be proactive. I know. And that's what I think with our vitamins, that's what it is. It's, you know, it's investing for your future.
Exactly.
And the younger you are, the more time you have to make that investment. And I agree with you. I mean, being in this work here with the aging research, it just, everywhere I turn and I see people suffering from aging, it's just, it's a heartbreak to me. And it just causes me to pray and want to work all the harder for the Lord to advance this work so that life can be sustained and suffering can be reduced in whatever ways that God will allow. So you've shared a lot of valuable info today. I think this will be great for our listeners, and we will spread it out there as much as we can so your story can be a help to as many people as possible.
I'm glad to, and I recommend Dr. Aardman's anti-aging vitamins to everyone. I mean, get on board and enjoy your life, a healthy life. That's what we strive for, you know.
Well, thank you, Larry. We appreciate it so much.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that concludes the interview, and how encouraging. God is good to give us these discoveries, and you are welcome as well to get a hold of these vitamins, and you can go. We try to make it as easy as possible. Go to our store website. There's a link in the show notes. You can easily get there from our podcast website, thebcmessenger.com, and you can easily obtain Dr. Aardman's anti-aging vitamins as well.
We take orders through the mail now as well. We've been doing quite a bit of that lately, and many people are receptive to just wanting to send in a check and do it the old-fashioned way. They don't want to do anything on the computer, and that's fine. If that's you, we would love to serve you that way as well. Now we will lead into Helen's View, our final section of the podcast today, as she shares more lessons, part two, Lessons from the Life of Charles Goodyear.
Lessons from the Life of Charles Goodyear, part two. Here's what we learned in part one. Lesson one, our vision, seeing things as they can be. People in Goodyear's time saw things as they were. Following the collapse of the rubber boom, they were convinced that rubber as a useful tool was a dead idea. Goodyear had the vision to see things as they could be, a cure for rubber, which could be used to save many lives. Most people today think aging and dying at 70 years and 10 is just the way it is. All of us who are part of the ARP team share a vision of what it can be, a cure for the disease of aging to save billions of lives. Lesson 2 takes a critical look at the value of public opinion. The early years. Stephen and Amasa Goodyear gave birth to Charles Goodyear on December 29, 1800, in New Haven, Connecticut. Charles had the privilege of growing up on a farm where he learned perseverance and persistence as he worked alongside his parents, something that proved invaluable all of Goodyear's life. Charles came from a long line of inventors, including his father, Stephen. Charles helped his father in his manufacturing of ivory buttons, as well as farm work. At age 16, he left home and went to Philadelphia to learn a new trade, the hardware business, where he continued his diligence in his work. When he was 21, he came back to Connecticut and became a partner with his father. They manufactured ivory and metal buttons and also agricultural implements. When Charles was 24, he married Clarissa Beecher, who became a true helper to her husband. Clarissa had remarkable strength of character and a very kind nature. She endured many financial and emotional hardships in her marriage to Charles Goodyear. There is no doubt that Charles could never have accomplished what he did with his life if it hadn't been for Clarissa. I believe that behind many famous men is a dedicated and supportive wife. After being married for 2 years, they moved to Philadelphia, where Charles opened his first hardware store. He began selling his specialty farming implements. Business was booming as the farmers clamored for the newest technology of the day. It looked like the Goodyears were going to be very wealthy. But it was not to be. Poor health, stomach ailments, in 1830, as well as business failure of his partnership with his father, meant financial ruin. Early work with rubber. We learned in the last episode how Goodyear's attention was brought to rubber and how he tried to improve the life preserver. Through an interesting series of events, Goodyear felt God's calling on his life to figure out how to cure rubber and make it usable, not only to save lives with life preservers, but for many other practical purposes. With great excitement, he returned to Philadelphia from the Roxbury Rubber Company, only to be arrested by a creditor and thrown into prison. Of course, he used his downtime in prison to work on his very first experiments with India rubber. The raw materials, called gum, were very cheap. He used his hands to mix the gum with some magnesia, which made a very nice white compound. The gum was no longer sticky. He thought he was onto a solution. He borrowed money and began processing rubber in his wife's kitchen. His wife and children helped him. His raw ingredients were India rubber, lamp black, and magnesia, which then was dissolved in turpentine and spread on flannel cloth. These were then used to line shoes. But eventually the gum became very sticky. His creditors, fed up, decided that the research needed to stop. No money, no research. Goodyear, undaunted in his calling from God, sold the family furniture, put his family in a boarding house, and went to work in an attic in New York. A druggist assisted financially. Goodyear next tried compounding rubber with magnesia and boiling it in quicklime and water. It appeared to work. Folks around the world were buzzing with the news. Goodyear received international acclaim, but it was short-lived. As is often the case, continued research tests the thesis further, and old ideas collapse. Goodyear persisted. He performed more in-depth experiments. He would mix the chemicals in his attic in New York and then walk 3 miles to a mill in Greenwich Village to do the actual experiments. A new thesis began to develop as he worked, thought it all through, and worked some more. He discovered that rubber dipped in nitric acid formed a surface cure. Many of the products he made with his rubber were well thought of. Even Andrew Jackson commended Goodyear for his work. Working with harsh chemicals began to take its toll on Goodyear. This was long before the days of proper ventilation. Once he nearly suffocated. He became very ill and nearly died. A new business partner came on board. Together they built a factory and began making rubber shoes, life preservers, and even clothing. The family was once again united. They moved to Staten Island to be near their father and the factory. Things were looking good, but the panic of 1838 took away all of his business partner's fortune, and Goodyear was once again financially devastated. The family camped in the abandoned rubber factory. Goodyear caught fish from the harbor to feed them all. By this time, nearly everyone was calling Goodyear the Indian rubber maniac and wanted nothing to do with him. Unstoppable, Goodyear went back to Boston and to his friend Jay Haskins of the Roxbury Rubber Company. Haskins lent him money and stood by him. And Mr. Chaffee also was very kind to Goodyear, offering a listening ear, very important to inventors because as they talk it over, they are able to come to even better ideas, and also helped Goodyear financially. Mr. Chaffee invented a large machine for mixing the chemicals by mechanical means. The rubber items that were created using this machine were beautiful to look at, but ultimately not all the difficulties were overcome. After receiving a patent for this new process, Goodyear sold the patent to the Providence Company in Rhode Island. But the goods still could not withstand hot or cold temperatures. The items that were sold were returned to the manufacturer. Despite the failure to get the final perfect product at this point in Goodyear's life, the research was still moving forward. Each failure brings a new understanding which creates new ideas to try. Lesson 2. Public opinion, the worst of all opinions. I find it really encouraging that even though almost everyone at that time thought Goodyear was crazy, no one would say so now. Before a successful invention, crazy. After successful invention, genius. But there has to be a before to get to the after. I would like to end with this quote. Courage, moral courage, the courage of one's convictions, the courage to see things through. The world is in a constant conspiracy against the brave. It's the age-old struggle, the roar of the crowd on one side and the voice of your conscience on the other. By General Douglas MacArthur.
If you're new to the podcast, you should know that Helen is Dr. Aardsma's wife, and she brings a behind-the-scenes look, shares what's been on her mind in relation to the research here.
Well, we certainly are standing on the shoulders of giants from the past, and two of them have come up in our podcast today, Albert Einstein and now Charles Goodyear. And it is encouraging to think about who God is bringing along today and will in the future to bring important discoveries into this world as Jesus Christ is building his kingdom and redeeming all things back to himself.
Hey, if you get a chance, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever you listen. But leaving us a review or sharing on your social media, any of those things will help us more than you know and help spread the message of this podcast, as you too can have a part in standing on the shoulders of giants and building upon all the foundations that have been laid in the past and helping to advance new truth and important information out into the world today.
We'll see you next month. Thank you for joining us.